CBS Monday.
NCIS!
Here's where we can see them.
NCIS and NCIS Hawaii return with all new cases.
Double tap to the chest, one to the head.
These guys are professionals.
All new criminals.
Violent island that got here.
Welcome to paradise.
And all new crimes to be solved.
If you're watching this, I've been arrested.
What are the charges?
Just one. Murder.
New NCIS and NCIS Hawaii, Monday, starting at 9, 8 central, on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. This Earth Week, you can live stream seven national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
What's up? Welcome back to Barton and Bud. I'm Barton Simmons, along with Bud Elliott. We are from Christmas break, the Christmas holiday. Bowl season is upon us. We're swimming in toddler presents over here in the Simmons household. And I'm fortunate right now that with school out, I've got a little window here where hopefully we can talk without me getting interrupted. Christmas with Liam and the crew go pretty good your way?
Went pretty well. He got multiple power wheels. He's actually scared to ride in them because he's 18 months old. But he got a garbage truck. So that was a big hit, like a play garbage truck. And his reactions are, he hits buttons and make noise. He loves it, man.
He's a big garbage guy. I've noticed that about Liam.
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, it comes twice a week, you know, Tuesday, Friday mornings, he's there. He's all about it. That's, he hears it pull up, garbage truck. So we go out there and look at it.
Couple things, man.
Dude.
Just a dude loving garbage.
Exactly.
So we've got some big news that we haven't quite hit on yet. We got Brian Harsin to Auburn. We also have some big games coming up. College football playoffs. We're going to break down. Do you want to start with the games? Do you want to start with Brian Harsin?
I think we should probably start with the games here. So if people are, we're trying to get this out early before all the other podcasts drop their previews. Now there's inherent risk in this because we don't know the results of these COVID tests, but I mean, damn, if we waited all year to drop previews before we had all the COVID results, we just never dropped podcasts, and that's not a great business model. So
Trevor is immune though. So, you know, with Trevor immune, that's probably Justin Fields. Apparently, all he does is hang out in his apartment, so I'm not worried about him.
He's low risk.
As long as those guys are playing. Yeah. As long as those guys are playing, we're good.
Yeah, I also think, like, the next great college football scandal is, like, that we find out that, like, Nick Saban got the vaccine for everybody, like, last month, you know, just to be safe. All right, so going to New Orleans, Ohio State, Clemson. This is the game that we wanted in the preseason. Like in our preseason brainstorm calls, like, man, we got to get Trevor and Justin, get the rematch, Ohio State, Clemson, Dabo versus Ryan Day. Like this is the sexy matchup of these playoff games to me. I mean, you have Dabo ranking Ohio State 11th in the poll, which is kind of hilarious. And going back on what he said prior that, he didn't think it should be held against them in the preseason that they only played X number of games. This is kind of spicier than it normally would be for teams that don't play, you know, all that often. I'm excited to watch this one, man. I really am. What stands out to you when you dig into these teams?
Honestly, I think that, and I was talking to a coach last night, and he actually, I kind of brought it up, and then he kind of hit home and sort of convinced me of this point. I think that Dabo is watching Ohio State film right now, and he is licking his chops. And I think he feels like he is going to absolutely, like, handle this Ohio State team. Because if he didn't think that, why the hell would he be giving them all this bulletin board material? Like, why would he be volunteering all these chips on the shoulders for the Ohio State Buckeyes? I think he is absolutely leaning into the villain role because he knows that they're going to go out there and be a lot better. And I think the main reason that that confidence is there, and the main advantage that this Clemson team has. And look, it's big to have seen them coming off that Notre Dame win because of the way they beat Notre Dame. Yes, Trevor Lawrence was awesome running the football. Travis Etienne got off a little bit more, but the past game kind of came alive, and the you know, whether it's EJ Williams, one-handed catch on the sideline, some of the young guys starting to emerge. I just think Ohio State defensively has some issues in the secondary. They just do. They've got, like, this is not a great back end, and they've had issues all year long. I think Clemson is the team to exploit those. And I'll say this too, on the other side of the ball, I don't want to go so far as to say it's been a regression year for Justin Fields, but it hasn't been sharp. And I do think we've seen a lot We've seen more indecision, more holding on to the football too long. And those sort of issues are going to pop up when you're playing a Brent Venables defense. So I just think where these teams are sort of where Ohio State's lacking, I guess, is our areas where Clemson can really put the heat on and really kind of pin them in. So I think that between those sort of offensive and defensive issues, between Dabo Swinney kind of telegraphing his confidence here, I'm starting to feel like this could be Clemson taking care of business.
Look, it certainly could. And I agree with you, you know, on a lot of those points. I do feel though that they're, let's just say this. I don't see much of a path, spoiler alert here, for the Irish to beat Alabama, right? It's difficult for me to imagine that happening. It's not saying it's possible, but it's not likely. 7.5 here is a decently big number. And Clemson is playing much better down the stretch with the return of Trevor Lawrence. They're playing better with the return of, or rather with the emergence of Cornell Powell at outside receiver. Because they already have a nice slot, and they already have ETN. But Ohio State is talented enough, I do think, that if they click here, they can spring the upset. And we didn't pre-plan this with, you know, Barton saying, I want to take the Clemson side, and I want to take the Ohio State side. I think it's just kind of how this is, you know, maybe this is going to go down. Ohio State, receiver-wise, is probably the toughest set of receivers that Clemson has seen all year. I mean, I'm trying to think. They didn't have to play North Carolina. Miami does.
Well, I mean, they may be the best group of receivers,
sure,
in the country.
Right.
Right. So,
I mean, this is like an order of magnitude above anything else they've played, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So, like, we really haven't seen this Clemson secondary tested by an elite receiver group, because they didn't play UNC. Notre Dame didn't have Braden Lindsey, and they didn't have Kevin Austin. So, I mean, they were basically playing guys on the outside for Notre Dame who were kind of backups entering the season. Miami doesn't scare anybody at the receiver position. I'm going through my head here as far as who Clemson played, and I really don't think they played anybody who scares you very much at receiver. And so we haven't seen this Clemson defense have to play in such a way where it really has to worry about getting tore up in the passing game. They've been able to kind of go out and play for those tackles for loss and, you know, play singles on the outside like Brent Venables likes to do. I'm interested to see how they handle an Ohio State passing game, which, A, on the one hand, I agree with you. I don't think Fields has – I'm not going to say like you did. I agree with you. I don't think it's fair to say he's regressed. I just don't think he has noticeably progressed this year. But those receivers are nasty, and they didn't have Chris Olave in the Big Ten title game. They're missing a couple other important guys as well. It seems like Ohio State is pretty healthy going into this game. Clemson is getting healthier as well. Ohio State's ability to hit the big play, I think, could be the equalizer in this ballgame. They're a little bit more explosive than Clemson is in certain areas. Clemson's defense does have a propensity to kind of give up the home run shot on the back end. I mean, they're 90th in the country in passing explosiveness allowed, which I think is partially by style. I mean, Venables is okay with giving up the bombs if you can hit them, right? It's just, it's hard to hit them on this defense. But when they do hit them, the size of those bombs is pretty big. I also think one thing that we didn't get to see last year's game that might be different this year is Justin Fields last year was banged up going to that game. He really couldn't run very much, and they didn't design run him hardly at all. And I think he struggled to get out of some of those pressures that Clemson was bringing. As far as I know, he's healthy now. I think this is a game they go all out running Justin Fields against Clemson. Keeping the ball out of the hands of Trevor Lawrence, keeping that Ohio State defense off the field. I think Ohio State tries to man up and run the football on them and then hit play action shots. Because like you said, Fields has not been good this year, just dropping back, reading the defense, getting rid of the ball on time. If it's not quick game, if it's not play action, he's kind of just been, you know, good, not great.
I think that's an interesting prediction, probably a good call, that you could see Ohio State lean on Justin Fields in the run game a little bit more. He hasn't done it. I'm just looking at his numbers right now. Like, it's not as if he's run it a lot this year. He had 12 carries for 35 yards against Northwestern. He had a big game run against Michigan State. He had 78 yards against Indiana. And then he had not much against Rutgers, not much against Penn State. But I do think that that's like in as a way to just sort of add a new wrinkle, kind of the like almost the way that Clemson was it last year that all of a sudden Trevor Lawrence turned into, he was, wasn't it? Where Trevor Lawrence turned into like a
long run.
Yeah, he's like the workhorse running the football all of a sudden at the end of the season there for Clemson. I could see that because I do think that that makes sense and try. And because look, here's the concern, I think, as much as anything, is just I just don't know that Ohio State is going to get a lot of stops on this Clemson team. That's kind of where I'm most confident. And so, look, if Justin Fields can come out there and play his kind of game and like ball out it and get the ball to Olave and Wilson and all those guys, then this could be a shootout and Ohio State's got a shot to win. I just have a lot more confidence in producing offensively, and I have just a little bit more hesitation in Ohio State's ability to do the same. Not that I don't think they can, but I just want one I'm like really confident in, and the other I kind of, you know, I could see it both ways.
This could also be a pretty big ETN game. I like you, I share concerns about the Ohio State pass defense and giving up big plays and just the breakdowns there in pass coverage. But something else that stands out on my screen as red, explosive rushes allowed. Ohio State, 109th in the nation on a percentage basis. I mean, guys, there's only like 127 teams playing this year because you had, you know, a couple that weren't playing or didn't play enough games to qualify. 109th is bad. Now, I think part of that was some of the newness on defense and the pieces fitting together. And I mean, hell, Nebraska had only 17 points, but they had a number of explosive rushes in that game. You know, Penn State had a couple, I think, that were, you know, that they were able to pop. Rutgers probably had a couple that were kind of like before garbage. Like, it wasn't technically garbage time, but everybody in the stadium knew it was basically garbage time by the actual just watching the game, not the stats definition. You know, being able to look outside the box score. But 109th is 109th. I mean, that's still problematic if you're 109th in rush explosiveness defense. And Travis Etienne is like number one in rush explosiveness. So, man, that's a concern. I think that if you can't make Clemson one-dimensional, it is just so hard to beat Trevor Lawrence. And that's what Notre Dame was able to do the first time, except they didn't have to play Trevor Lawrence, right? They had to play, DJ. So,
right,
it's going to be tough. But I
think that's what's so tough about Clemson right now is what Trevor Lawrence has become, which is almost like he is a true dual threat quarterback. I mean, that's why I think Clemson, that is the missing element here that makes Clemson this juggernaut. And a little bit less beatable. If Trevor Lawrence or whoever is at quarterback is a stationary target and is just, and that's kind of how we view Trevor Lawrence early in his career, but he has morphed into this, I think, like legitimate dual threat quarterback. So you got Travis Etienne, you got to account for in the run game. You got Amari Rodgers and Cornell Powell and whoever you want to throw at on the perimeter in the pass game. And have this new, and I don't even want to call it new, but definitely an emphasized Trevor Lawrence run game that just, to me, is just sort of the icing on the whole thing and makes it that much more difficult. So yeah, and I think that's what makes, I think that helps Travis Etienne's explosiveness as well. So it's just going to be a real, and look, I think Jeff Hafley's not being here at Ohio State to this point has been noticeable. And as close as last year's game was, I think his absence is probably significant. If you're looking at that sort of like how different these teams are 2019 versus 2020, I think one significant difference is Jeff Hafley isn't on that sideline as defensive coordinator.
All right. So put on your kind of crystal ball here. Or put on your crystal ball. What is that? So get out your crystal ball, right?
Your magician hat or something.
Yeah, exactly. The Swami hat here.
Right.
We're doing an episode 6 days from now. And Ohio State has beaten Clemson. Mm-hmm. What in your mind went right for Ohio State or went wrong for Clemson?
I think I like your sort of approach that Justin Fields was a real factor in the run game. I think they probably got a red zone turnover or something to that effect, and they were able to put up a ton of points and just you kind of win in a shootout. It's just hard for me to envision this being like some sort of, you know, I don't know, 21-17 kind of game. Like it just feels like this is going to be a lot of points scored. And so if Ohio State's going to win it, it's going to have to be behind Ryan Day and Justin Fields, Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, and that crowd. And they're very capable of that. And so I guess that's kind of what I'm envisioning is just they get the ball last.
This Ohio State team reminds me a little bit just in terms of like it's kinetic energy, it's potential because of the talent of that 2014 Florida State team, right? Which ultimately never put it together. Now they put it together for about 20 minutes in the first half and Jalen Ramsey drops the, you know, the pick six going the other way. And, you know, Dalvin Cook, you know, fumbles twice. One of which was, you know, going for a long score and then it just absolutely snowballed on him. But it, there was something in your mind. It was like, okay, you're not going to pick Florida State to win that game over Oregon because they haven't put it together all year. But it wouldn't completely shock you if they did, just because you know how many of those dudes are going to have their names called on draft night. And I think with Ohio State, because they have played only six games and because they have had COVID issues in several of those games, I don't have a great handle on what this team's ceiling looks like. I think I've seen its floor. I just don't know about its ceiling. I think I agree with you that Clemson. It's just much easier to trust Clemson with Trevor. It's already kind of gone through some of its trials and tribulations, and it's come out on the other side better for it. They seem to have found their answers. They know their offensive line is, you know, good but not great, and they seem to be playing around it, and they've corrected for it. We're kind of yet to see Ohio State fix all of its issues.
Yeah, to me, there's just a few. Like I'm not trying to be overly negative about Ohio State, but it does feel like there is something missing with this team. It just feels like it's just a little, like it hadn't been quite as clean as you want it to be. And usually I think the Florida State example is a great one. Like that thing, just everyone just kept on expecting a little more and it just never did fully come together. And then when in the big game, like that's, they got a little bit exposed. So we'll see. I mean, maybe it does come together for Ohio State. There's no question they're talented enough. But the trust factor for sure for me is in the Clemson camp.
I also kind of think about what are the weaknesses of these teams and who is better, not from a stats perspective, but like from a personnel perspective. I think like what's the worst unit on Clemson's team? Probably the offensive line. I think. I mean, just like the unit doesn't stand out as like a national championship caliber.
That's nothing new for Clemson. They always, they've been like surviving with that for the entirety of this run.
Right. No, that's fair. And they schemed around it beautifully. Several national championship games in a row. I don't think Ohio State's D-line is great. Like it's Haskell Garrett and then potential, but it's not Haskell Garrett and proven playmakers, you know. On the other side, I would say Ohio State's secondary is probably its weakness that you'd want to attack, most likely. And a couple of months ago, I probably wouldn't have said Clemson is super prepared to do that. But now with Powell emerging, you have Rodgers or throwing the ball well to ETN, and Lawrence's legs just put that much more stress on the secondary in terms of, you know, what kind of coverages you can call and what you want to play. I'm on your side here. I think Clemson is I think Clemson is the correct favorite. I don't know if I want to lay more than one score.
So what, how do we attack this Alabama Notre Dame game? How do you want to approach this? Do you want to try to bend your mind in knots and figure out what the path to victory is for Notre Dame? Or are we just throwing our hands up on this one?
I think I just kind of want to make a statement about Notre Dame, right? I do not think Notre Dame's a fraud. I think that they're legitimately a... I think there's about four teams, maybe five, that you could make a really good case for that are the number four quality team in the country. This year, I think there's a pretty good drop-off between Bama, Clemson, Ohio State, and then everybody else. And probably a drop-off, honestly, between Bama and those next two. So, I don't...
And even Bama and Clemson, probably.
Yeah, right. I don't think
it's under... Like we just said, and we'll see. I guess, that's now feels like I'm piling on Ohio State. But if to me, it feels like one and two, and definitely one, and then everybody else.
I think that's fair, right? And, I mean... Sample size, obviously, the Ohio State makes it kind of tough. Notre Dame, we have a pretty good sample size on. But I don't think there's any argument that Notre Dame really didn't deserve to go. And this is a much better team, I think, than the team that got crushed by Bama in that 2012 Orange Bowl where was Eddie Lacy was just spin-moving guys and looked like he ate the whole deer, not just the deer antler spray. You know, I mean, the guy they were just... Physically, they were that much better. And maybe in this game, that will be the case. But I do think that Notre Dame has proved it itself that it belongs in the playoff conversation. And it's unfortunate for them that they have to play, this Alabama team in this year. Because this is not a great matchup, I don't think, for Notre Dame, both personnel-wise and then also stylistically. Some stuff that scares me a little bit here on this side of things. Notre Dame's offense, I know we have kind of had a little mea culpa on Ian Book. He's better than we used to think he was. He's still not, I don't think, on the level of the other quarterbacks in this playoff. And I do put Mac Jones over him, even though Mac Jones has much better weapons. Alabama is number six in passing explosiveness. Notre Dame is 69th. The problem here is that you have this nice team. They're hitting some singles. They're hitting some doubles. Hey, man, we scratched out a run. That was nice. How they turned a double play to prevent the big rally. Bama's like, walk, single, three-run jack. And all of a sudden, you're down 3-1. And they just you keep trading sevens for threes. And it's very tough to compete with the big playability. We've talked about this all season. Like, the really elite teams in college football are the ones that are hitting these huge plays consistently. And Bama just hit the ball over the fence way, way more often than Notre Dame does. And that's a problem. The other thing I see is that Notre Dame's defense kind of dares you to do this stylistically. And they're very good defensively. I really like Notre Dame's defense quite a bit. I think Clark Lee does an awesome job. Now the Vanderbilt coach, and they're 11th in SP Plus defense per Bill Connolly. But they're 79th in passing explosiveness allowed. Like, that's the one thing. This Notre Dame defense is like, hey, all right, we dare you to beat us over the top. And Bama's like, all right, see, strap in here. So that's problematic, man. And Notre Dame doesn't have Braden Lindsey. They don't have Kevin Austin. And, guys, they lost to injury early in the season. It certainly, I don't think we should forget that. It limited their potential as far as their upside in the pass game. But now they also don't have their starting center, or I believe their backup center as well. And the main strength of this Irish team on offense was that offensive line and controlling the ball, not putting Ian Book in bad down and distance, letting Ian Book have as much time in the pocket as he possibly needed to process the defense he was seeing and make the right read. I don't think their O-line was nearly as good in round two against Clemson. And I understand the Tigers had some guys back that they didn't have in round one. I think part of that was the offensive line injuries that they've suffered. So I just don't think this Notre Dame team is peaking at the right time to have a real shot to pull this upset.
Yeah. I agree. So I think the as I look at Alabama in this year, so the teams that are probably most similar to Alabama teams that are probably most similar to Notre Dame that Alabama's played, probably Texas A&M and Georgia. in terms of, you know, playing. They're going to play good defense. They're pretty good up front. They're going to try to pound the rock on offense. And both those games, let's see, what was it, 28 points and 17 points were the two margins of victory. The teams that have actually threatened Alabama, I don't know if we really count Ole Miss as threatening Alabama, but whatever, 63-48, there were some sweats there at some point. I think Nick Saban was relieved to get out of there. And then Florida, 52-46, and Florida was just able to get in a little bit of a shootout. I just don't know if this Alabama team is beatable unless you can get in a shootout with them. I'm not saying that they are unbeatable, but I don't know that the style of play that Notre Dame is going to use to try to beat this Alabama team just can do it. And that's not to say that Notre Dame is choosing the wrong style of play. I mean, they have to do what their strengths are. They can't try to go be Ole Miss against this Alabama team. They're not capable of that. But Alabama's just that they make the most out of every at bat. Like they're just too damn good at every at bat. Like I'm trying to think of like even saying something like, well, if Notre Dame can just, you know, force them to kick field goals in the red zone, and then possess the football. And Brian Kelly has indicated that he's almost conceded, like, look, we're gonna have to try to possess the football in this game. It's just a reality. I just don't know that Alabama does kick field goals. Like I'm looking at their Bill Conley's numbers. They're sixth in the country in points per scoring opportunity. So I just don't know what it looks like. I mean, obviously there are ways. I mean, you get a few turnovers, get a few big plays, you get a few long drives, you force field goals, you get some red zone turnovers, whatever. Like there's a lot of things that could happen to make this Notre Dame game closer or a potential upset, but it's just really hard to envision because the things that would happen are very uncharacteristic of Alabama.
I completely agree there. I mean, it is hard to imagine how this goes down. I think you're right. It's Notre Dame plays a little bit more conservatively defensively, does not allow the big play. Alabama gets impatient maybe and tries to create the big play when it's not there. They throw a couple of interceptions. I do think this Notre Dame defense is more physical and more athletic than people are giving it credit for. Like there's a lot of this media narrative out there that, oh, hey, these guys, you know, we saw what happened last time they get in the playoff. And yeah, but that Bama offense that boat raced them in the Orange Bowl was not like, that's not nearly as good as this Bama offense. This is a whole different animal. And so having a result similar to that in this game, I think is not quite the same, you know, verdict, right? Maybe if Bama turns it over a couple times, Notre Dame cashes in its own red zone opportunities, and then the Irish are able to hit some kind of big plays. That's possible. Bama has allowed big plays at times this year, particularly, you know, through the air. They've had some busts. But let's pull out our beating Nick Saban rubric. We went over this with A&M and also with Georgia in those games. So those are basically the two games, and then a little bit for the Florida and Bama thing. Do you have guys who can win one-on-one matchups on the outside? Because if not, Saban's going to sit in one-on-one matchups on the outside every single time and force you to beat it. And the answer for A&M, ultimately because of injury and because of opt-out, was no. And the answer for Georgia was kind of no, although I think that, you know, they used some nice young guys and the kid from California who was committed to LSU for a while.
Jermaine Burton.
Yeah. Like they did some nice things there, but they were also playing a dude who was a walk-on at quarterback. And for a month, we, you know, were kind of force-fed that narrative that he was better than a walk-on. But you know, now we're seeing he's probably not. Who on the Irish on the outside scares you? Like, is Pat Surtain? You think he's sleeping pretty well this week? Because I do.
Nobody does. That's the problem. And maybe the answer, because everyone's got to find these alternate answers. in the playoffs. We talked about the Trevor Lawrence thing last year, running the football. And Kyren Williams has been one of the best quarterback, one of the best running backs in college football. But I wonder if there's an increased role for a guy like maybe Chris Tyree in this game, the really speedy true freshman, and his ability to maybe be a just like a wheel route guy or an angle route guy out of the backfield, and just because they got to find a way to generate, they do need to find a way to generate some big plays. They need to find a way to score points. There's just the dam's going to break at some point in that game. And so they've got to be able to match and score some points. And so, look, they've got some weapons, but I just wonder where, you know, whether they're going to be able to find some additional big plays and where they come from.
So I was on, I forget what radio show it was, but it was last week, and they had me on. And they were talking about how, you know, Nick Saban has built this defense now to counteract the spread offense, right? And maybe this defense isn't prepared to go back and play more of a pro style type offense. And I'm like, man, I get that, but I don't know. Like, Nick Saban is pretty damn good at,
yeah,
like, this is kind of what he made his bread and butter on. Like, they shut down those pro style offenses for a long time. I mean, LSU didn't cross the 50 until the thing was over, right? So yeah, that I don't know. I don't want to denigrate Notre Dame here. I think they've actually had a really nice year. I think this is a damn good football team. It's just, A, I don't think they're picking at the right time, given their injuries and their personnel. And B, I just don't like this matchup for them. Like, I wouldn't be talking this way if it was Notre Dame, Ohio State. You know, and after seeing the Clemson game, obviously you're not going to pick Notre Dame to beat those guys. But I don't think we'd be talking like they have zero shot to beat Clemson.
Yeah, I think Ohio State is more equipped to beat Alabama. Yeah. That said, I don't think anyone that's not in, like, throw A&M in there, like any of the other candidates that hit the fourth spot, I don't think would be any better shape right now in this conversation than what we're having. And I mean, I don't count Florida because they missed their opportunity. They got three losses. But anybody else that would be claiming that they deserve a shot in this four hole, good luck. You can get the same treatment in this conversation that Notre Dame's getting.
All right, so be Nick Saban. Rank the teams for the four hole that you would most like to play to least like to play. Oklahoma, Notre Dame, Florida, A&M.
Oklahoma, Notre Dame, Florida, A&M. I would most like to play A&M, then Notre Dame, then probably Oklahoma, and then Florida. I still think Florida is, I long thought Florida was sort of they just look like the fourth best team in the country to me. That doesn't mean that they should be in the playoffs. They shouldn't. They lost three games. But in terms of best chance at winning on a neutral site in any given Saturday or whatever, I'm probably going to take Florida over most of those other, but Oklahoma's close because just Oklahoma can have a game where they're just that good and they just have things click and they got playmakers and they got a quarterback that can get hot. And so Oklahoma definitely can make a case, but I think Alabama just beat the team that's most equipped to beat them outside the top three.
I think that's right. I mean, the way I would put it is Florida's best, I think, is the best out of those four teams. They just, you know, they didn't play their best on two notable games, including, if you look at the O'Connell stuff, the most improbable win of the year as far as like what actually happened in the game and, you know, what the result was. But it counts if the shoe fits.
What was that game? The A&M game?
No, the LSU game.
Oh.
I think it was like a 1% post-game win probability or something crazy like that I saw on Bill's Twitter there. All right, we should probably take a break and sell some ads. You know, we got to pay bills, got to buy some toys for Christmas and birthdays and all this stuff. So when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit on the Auburn job, the hiring of Brian Harsin, maybe a little bit of what went down there. And we're going to use our, of course, Barton and Bud grading scale of the love it, get it, don't get it hiring judgment as opposed to letter grades, since, you know, coaching searches are kind of a wash. All right.
It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sanfel, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
And we're back. So, Barton, over the break, Auburn hires Brian Harsin. That is, I'll admit that once the Kevin Steele coup didn't officially, like, fully form, I really didn't know what was going to happen with this coaching search. And Billy Napier allegedly turned down Auburn. He may luck his way into, you know, being fought over by Texas and LSU next year, potentially. Much like Tom Herman did 4 years ago. Who knows? Just throwing it out there. But I did not see Brian Harsin being hired for this job. And I'm not saying it's a bad hire. Just this is not a guy that I had on my radar. It's kind of one of those ones that makes you think.
Hell of a job by Auburn keeping that thing under wraps. I mean, there was all kinds of reporting going on. All kinds of, you know, this guy turned that down. This guy's out of the mix. This guy's going to interview. I didn't hear Brian Harsin's name once. And the whole time, until he was announced as the head coach, I did not hear his name once. And so that leads me to believe that perhaps, and I'm not saying there was any fake news, but the people that were feeding the reporters the information, I don't know that they really had the full information themselves. I think that it appears Alan Green, the Auburn athletic director, kept a tighter circle than it initially seemed. And so props on you, man. I will grade the hire. My three options are don't get it, get it. And what's our best?
Love it.
Love it, get it, don't get it. I grade this a get it. Here's the reason I like it. And then, you know, we can talk about some of the things to worry about in it as well. But here's the reason I like it. I think I talked about this in one of these other coaching search situations too. But like there's this kind of silly perspective that, like, you know, in order to beat Saban, in order to win the SEC, got to get somebody that knows how to, it's been there, like knows how to do it. Like, got to get somebody that's recruited in those wars, that has played in the big games in that conference, has had Gary Danielson calling his games. And like, why do we have to think like that? Maybe the exact thing we need to do is to find someone that does it totally different. And someone that's just a really good football coach and can come in and install and instill a really strong culture and do it a different way and make the SEC adapt to them. I make no mistake. I mean, there are challenges in that league and there's standards in that league that no other league in college football has to match. But you can do it. There's different ways to skin a cat. And I think that Brian Harsin comes in and there's things are a little foreign to him, but this is a guy that's been just absolutely fiending for a football program and a football conference that prioritizes football in a more meaningful way. Like he's been basically like fighting with the Mountain West or fighting with the Boise State administration, at least, to try to like get the hell out of the Mountain West. I mean, that's a guy that wants to play in the big games. Like that's a guy that's frustrated. And so that speaks to me to a little bit of enthusiasm and passion and competitiveness that probably you do need for this job. So my initial reaction was, yeah, okay, I'm with it. I can deal with this. This is a good hire. I think this makes sense. Now let's see what happens, because it could go the other way too.
So Nick Saban's favorite memory of coaching in the SEC before he got to LSU was... No, didn't have one. Right. And Urban Meyer's favorite SEC memory of coaching in the SEC before Florida. Right. Yeah. Didn't have one. So the guys who have won like seven of the SEC's, 11 championships in this millennia, never coached in the SEC before they got to those schools at which they won their first SEC, or their first title in the SEC. Now, that said, I do think there are some challenges. Not that you have to have experience, right, of coaching the SEC, but I think you need to at least have a plan for them, and you need to be aware of the realities of them. Like, recruiting down here is a different game. It's why you see people in the Big Ten and the Pac-12 complain when one coach starts to kind of push the limits, right? And we're going to recruit guys who are verbally committed elsewhere. We're going to, you know, maybe do a little extra benefit stuff that formerly didn't happen as much in this league. Or wait, we're giving a 3-star some extra benefits now? Like, normally that doesn't happen, right? Like, normally it's just everybody kind of knows some of the really top kids get a little something, and you know, everybody else just plays for the love of the game out here. But if you know that going in, that you may need to drop a couple casino chips for the parents on their ride home, or it's important that one of your boosters is a car guy or whatever, and you know that Auburn's expectation and one of the main reasons they fired Gus Malzahn is because he was losing battles to Georgia in the state of Georgia, and they didn't sign anybody from Georgia this year, and they were losing battles to Clemson and maybe slipping a little bit in Mobile to LSU and that type of thing, and that you need to be hashtag all in. If you know that going in, I don't think there's any real problem with hiring a guy who hasn't necessarily done it before, as long as he's aware of how this works and how the game needs to be played. Speaking of played, I want to play a clip right now from the 24/7 Sports Football Recruiting Show. And this is Brandon Huffman talking about Brian Harsin's recruiting style, so we'll give this a listen.
Further up north, Boise State lost Coach Brian Harsin over to Auburn. Let's start with that, because I feel like there's enough body of work of what he did in Boise to suggest that this wasn't just a Chris Peterson reboot. You know, obviously he kept a lot of the same methods and the same thought process and the way to evaluate, but I think he was far enough detached that he proved that he was very capable of taking a job in the SEC and taking a marquee job in the SEC. What do you think his ceiling is as a recruiter for the Auburn Tigers?
I've made this comparison for a number of years now, that Boise State basically is the Gonzaga of football when it comes to the West, where Boise State would win its share of recruiting battles over Pac-12 schools, and you weren't surprised anymore. Maybe early on, 15 years ago, when Dan Hawkins was still there, when Chris Peterson was getting started, you were still surprised when Boise State won a recruiting battle. But as we've gotten over the last few years, we've seen a number of Pac-12 recruits have half the Pac-12 recruiting them, and they still go to Boise State, whether it was Brett Rypien in the 2015 class, whether it was, you know, more recently, guys like J.R. Skinner, Hank Bachmeyer. You know, he has been able to really capitalize on Boise State's status as a football program, as one of the premier group of five programs. But it also showed that, you know, he could have gone after guys that were more low-hanging fruit and not tried to go and win key recruiting battles and go after the guys that maybe Boise State had a more realistic chance at. Now he's going up against arguably the greatest dynasty in college football over the last 20 years, and certainly over the last 15 years since Nick Saban's gotten there in Alabama. So intimidation cannot be a part of the package there. Harsin had to take that job knowing just how hard it was to recruit against his in-state foe, let alone the rest of the SEC. But this is a guy who has shown that he's okay recruiting against the big boys, maybe against schools that more realistically should be getting the players that Harsin was getting at Boise State. So I think he's got a lot of potential to recruit well at Auburn. obviously the downside is that the majority of his time, other than, you know, a couple assistant coaching stops at Texas or at Arkansas State, have been out west. So there isn't the familiarity or the comfort with schools in the South or with high school programs in the South, because he just hasn't really recruited down there. But Boise State has recruited Florida. Boise State's recruited Texas. Boise State recruited the West Coast. So Harsin still has ties into three regions that he was able to recruit and pull guys to Boise. Now imagine trying to sell those same regions to the SEC. So I think that, you know, given that he's one of the few coaches in the SEC who's got extended time out west, obviously Mike Leach had time out west, Lane Kiffin as well. But I think given Harsin's experience as a head coach out west, it's going to be a little easier for him to recruit the West Coast at Auburn than maybe it was for Gus Malzahn or Gene Chizik prior to him.
Let me pose you this question. It's pretty general. It's pretty broad. And I'm just very interested to hear kind of your thoughts on this. Do you feel like it's more difficult to go from a Boise State to an Auburn from a recruiting standpoint and maybe broadening your recruiting pool? Or would it be easier to go the other way and maybe go from an Auburn to a Boise, where then it diminishes and it kind of minimizes the recruiting pool, the talent pool? You're only going after a specific recruit. I mean, there are a lot of challenges there when that pool expands and you have to, like you said, fight off some of these other SEC schools or battle it out for the five-star prospect instead of that borderline three-star that you know could has the potential to be an NFL player.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you look at what Chris Peterson did when he got to Washington and how he was able to recruit at Washington, going toe-to-toe with a lot of those recruits and those schools that he was going toe-to-toe, but now he was doing it with a Washington logo on his chest as opposed to a Boise State logo on his chest. And I think Harsin's going to have that going for him, where he's going to realize it's easier to sell Auburn to a kid from Florida and to Texas and from Texas than maybe it is to sell Boise State, because there is still that mentality and mindset. You know, Division I football is Division I football, but we have the Group of Five, we have the Power Five. But if you're not being recruited by a Power Five school, then maybe you're not as good as you think. And so I think he's going to find it's a little easier to recruit to Auburn, even if it is standing in the shadow of Alabama in state, even if it is having to go against recruits, against schools like Georgia and Florida and Tennessee and other SEC schools. I think there are obviously some disadvantages to Auburn, being that there's so many other SEC schools they're having to recruit against. But I think in the case of Harsin, there's so many advantages, where you're not convincing a kid to come to the Mountain West and play a game at 9 o'clock on a Thursday night or at 8 o'clock on a Saturday night. You're playing in the SEC, where those games are all on prime time or all during the day and everybody's watching it. And you look at, you know, Super Bowl MVPs from the SEC, NFL MVPs from the SEC. I think that advantage, when you've been at a school like Boise State, makes him the appeal is so much greater to a coach like that, because now he realizes he's got many more advantages in his back pocket to recruit a kid. I think the flip side is a lot of times we see this in basketball, where a coach maybe has been at a Power Five school or a high major program, then he goes to a mid-major program, and given their track record, you think recruiting would be that much easier, but it isn't. I mean, look at Jim McElwain. He was at Colorado State. He was trending upward, went from Colorado State to Florida. Now he's at Central Michigan, and recruiting isn't as easy to Central Michigan, isn't as easy to a Group of Five school. Using another Auburn example, Terry Bowden. When Terry Bowden was at Auburn, he had an undefeated season there. Then he was at Akron. I think now he's at Louisiana Monroe. It's a lot easier to recruit to those bigger schools than it is to the smaller schools. And there's also the budgetary differences. There's also the staff differences, the size of your staff that you don't have to worry about when you're at an SEC school compared to when you do at a Group of Five school. And I think that that's something that more coaches would rather go up rather than take the high power five job and go to a Group of Five, because there's so many more disadvantages when you're at a Group of Five school.
So really appreciate Huffman hitting us with that info there, and that's good intel. Nobody covers the West Coast like you know, Biggins and Huffman and Blair, so they do a great job on that show. I'm going to go ahead and give this a get it. I think you get an accomplished coach with a winning record. He's won multiple titles out there of the Mountain West. The reason I don't go as far as love it is because, not because of the lack of SEC experience, but you know, the lack of, you know, like major P5 experiences, maybe a little bit of a concern, slight. And also the fact that, you know, the guys who coached Boise previously some of them went on to great things, and some of them, you know, didn't go on to quite as good, you know, quite as good of things. Obviously, Chris Peterson did awesome when he got to Washington, but Dan Hawkins did not do a very good job at Colorado. But ultimately, I think this is a pretty good get for Auburn. Is he a major upgrade over Gus Malzahn? I don't know. It's tough for me to sit here and say he's a major upgrade over Malzahn, but sometimes you just need new blood, and I definitely don't think he's a downgrade.
I think that's a good reminder from Huffman that Brian is a good recruiter, because my snap immediate reaction is like, okay, like the Boise State OKG stuff, like our kind of guys, and like it's the Chris Peterson thing, and it's about whatever, five-star culture, other five-star prospects, and there is that laced in there, and that's important and good. That's a good thing. But now that Huffman is sort of my memory, I am sitting here thinking about, like, you know, George Helani was a four-star running back out of like the that top league down there in Southern California, the Trinity League, and like they land elite. They will, like, they'll go out and they'll land four-star kids. Like you said, they will beat. I mean, Hank Bachmeyer, the quarterback, had a bunch of, he was a four-star kid with a bunch of Pac-12 offers. Like, they have won those battles. And so I do think that that's good to remember and to remind ourselves of that. I'm interested in what, like, how his approach is going to work, because his press conference, and one of the things he said was he made a point that, like, they're going to recruit nationally, and whether he said it or whether he just implied it, I took it to mean they are going to recruit out west. And I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, to be honest with you. I know that, look, Alabama and LSU and Ohio State and all these schools are recruiting nationally. And so, yes, if you want to recruit with them, you got to recruit nationally. If you want to build national title teams, you got to have a national roster. And yet, so I guess we'll just, like, find out who he's recruiting out there. I mean, if he's out there just sort of hunting California for, I'm not sure that's necessarily the answer that Auburn's looking for on the recruiting trail, because the sleeper in California probably isn't better than the sleeper in Alabama. So I'm curious what that approach looks like.
I agree with you on that. I listened to this as well, and my thought was, for how long, right? If you're a new coach coming and taking over recruiting class, I'm actually working on a project right now, but man, your first recruiting class, this little short period class that he wasn't even hired before the signing period. So, like, you really can't put this one on him at all. Like, this is Kevin Steele's recruiting class. But if you're an outside hire, if you're not in an internal promotion like a Ryan Day or a Lincoln Riley, the attrition rates on your first class are enormous. I mean, you're talking about, in many of these cases, over half of the class being gone after just 2 years. I think a lot of it is just you're having to take these guys that you've not had time to foster relationships with. So if Brian Harsin is saying, hey, I got a lot of good relationships out on the West Coast, I know these players out on the West Coast, I'm going to go ahead and try to leverage those to the extent that I still know these kids out on the West Coast, you know, for now, maybe this class, maybe next year's class too, a little bit. Awesome. If that's his long-term strategy, I don't know if that works. We saw Auburn try to dip into Texas pretty heavily when it hired Chad Morris with kind of mixed results. They just lost Jaden Roberts, the offensive guard who flipped to Alabama over the weekend. You know, that I do think Auburn needs to do a better job in the Deep South, especially as some of these other programs try to go nationally. There is the risk of moving away from their base, and Auburn maybe can clean up a kid that maybe Clemson says, hey, we're going to go to Ohio to get this guy. Well, maybe there's a kid in Clemson's backyard or you know, on the Georgia border that Auburn can get. But as a short-term thing, I love it, man. Like, you need to use every possible resource that you can. I agree with you. And culturally, I hate to say this, some of these Cali kids don't strike me as being a tremendous fit at a place like Auburn, right? It's a different culture. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you think that Brian Harsin can make Auburn like a... Here's the problem. Here's what's hard. Is I'm sitting here thinking, like, all right, can Brian Harsin make Auburn like a Washington of the SEC, like a team that's, you know, Chris Peterson built Washington in by recruiting again, like OKGs, developing them. They were, you know, they're always going to play good defense. They're going to be a couple of really good players away from the playoffs. And maybe every once in a while they hit it, and they did the one time. I'm thinking, you know, if Brian Harsin does that at Auburn, then he's Gus Malzahn, basically, right? So that's what's really difficult about this hire is there's a lot of ways that we can envision this and say this is what success looks like, and yet that successful definition is what got the previous coach fired. And even within that sort of hypocrisy or conflict, I still don't even necessarily hate the idea of firing Gus Malzahn to go land. Like, if you landed another version of Gus Malzahn, then that's not so bad either. Hey, things are freshened up. And you kind of keep on rolling, doing what you're doing. You keep on having some success. And maybe you don't get to be national title contenders, but you still are what you are. And at least you get some new energy and new life and some new, you know, kind of fun again for the fans.
In 2 weeks, in a normal year, non-COVID, we would be going to Nashville or San Antonio or where else do we have the convention at? Normally it's kind of
Louisville.
Yeah. Right. So, like, you know, some of those type cities. I think Nashville is better than Louisville, but, you know, obviously. And you talk to these agents and you talk to assistant coaches and they're like, wait, why would this guy leave, right, for this job? And they use this term all the time. And the term is restart the clock, right? Now, Gus Malzahn did not leave to restart his own clock, clearly. That if he had left for Arkansas in 2017, you know, following the 17 season, that would have been an absolute restart the clock move. But I do think that Auburn kind of wanted to restart the clock because it saw its momentum as a program was not on the upswing, right? Bo Nix did not take the next step that he really needed to take under Chad Morris. The recruiting was not trending in the right direction. I mean, they were on the precipice of kind of becoming not just the number four team in their division, but sort of the number four program in their division in some ways, with LSU winning a title in 19, with A&M finishing number five in the polls this year, and both those teams beating Auburn in recruiting. I think they needed some new blood in there, so that's why I got it. Also, it's not my money, and they're not taking like education funds from the state of Alabama. This is two boosters primarily who ponied up this cash, who are very successful in business, and this is kind of like their pro franchise that they kind of own, except maybe they don't have quite the level of ownership they thought they did because they didn't get to pick the coach. You got to pick when the guy got fired, but not the new one.
Yeah. Well, have we covered all the angles on Harsin and Auburn? Anything left in the notebook there?
What defines success if you fired Gus? Is it like, do you think if he gives him the same results Gus gave him for, when did Gus get there? 2012?
Gus got what, 8 years?
Yeah.
Let's just say it. All right, let's just assume Gus got 8 years.
Pretty good 8 years.
Then I think Gus had a successful tenure, and he got fired after 8 years. And if Harsin gives them what Gus gave them, he will have had a successful tenure, and he'll get fired in 8 years. Like, I think that's kind of just, hey, they'll take another swing at it in 8 years, and it would have been a pretty fun, pretty successful, pleasing run to get there. But I just... that's kind of the way I see this. Maybe he lasts a little longer. I don't know. But I mean, look, I'm impressed with the dude. I mean, he is an intense, competitive guy, and that's probably quality number one you have to have in the SEC. I don't anticipate this raises the ceiling at Auburn necessarily. I think this is more of a high floor pick. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Because there's a lot of the guys that you like swing for the fences on, there's some pretty low floors with them, right?
Who would you have a Lovett pick for Auburn? Like who was on Barton's Lovett list if Brian Harsin is on the get it list?
I think I would have. I'm kind of big on Napier. I think I probably would have been willing to say love it with Napier.
That's fair.
But that might be the only one.
But it's not a no doubt slam dunk that you would say like, oh, for sure. Yeah. No,
nothing is.
And part of that is because the difficulty of the job and the expectations that are placed upon this guy. Like, they just fired Gus Malzahn, who had, you know, one of the best 8-year stretches in the history of the school.
Yeah. Unless you get an Urban Meyer, there really was no safe, like sure thing.
Can you imagine if we had Urban Meyer at Auburn? I mean, we would literally,
especially as much as Urban leans into the rivalry stuff, like
the school up north with Alabama.
That would have been sick. That'd have been a fun little, Urban is, he embraces gas on the fire and the rivalry stuff. So that would have been
maybe Harsin will stoke those fires as well. I mean, he's not afraid to speak his mind. Certainly.
His first question in the press conference was basically like, what do you think about Alabama? And he was like, he deflected it pretty effectively. Awesome. He did not embrace the question, but, that's going to be that's the new reality.
What is the right answer for that question? Like, I really respect what Coach Saban's done up there, obviously, but there's no reason we can't also achieve, you know, that elite level of success. I mean, basically, it's what you got to say, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess you can just totally be like, look, we have to beat Alabama. I'm here to beat Alabama. Nick Saban is the standard, but we're going to compete every day for that Alabama game, that Iron Bowl game. That would be with the Urban Meyer response. Yeah. Now, Brian Harsin's response was, we need to go 1-0 every day. I have no doubt that Urban Meyer would have been like, beating Alabama is the most important thing at this university. Every single day we work, we'll have the Iron Bowl in mind. And so that could have been the alternate response he could have taken. But the more coachy response is definitely 1-0 every day.
So Brian Harsin gets two, quote, get it grades from the Barton and Bud show, and certainly a much better coaching hire than we thought they were going to make after like the first 10 days of that search, based on the reports that were coming out. Like, much better.
That had some serious potential.
Oh, it did.
But Alan Green, you did it, man. Congratulations.
All right, guys, a quick update here. We really appreciate you sending in all these Apple Podcast reviews for us. In fact, we are at 750 ratings. However, Apple is not making me super confident in my choice to perhaps switch to an iPhone, which I think I'll do because everybody else 24/7 uses one, and I don't want to be the lone green texture forever. They have not updated the Apple reviews since December 11th. So we know you guys have been sending those in a lot, and you put your mailbag questions in there. You can certainly send those to us on Twitter at BudElliott3. At Barton Simmons. Is it Barton underscore Simmons? Or
just Barton Simmons. At Barton Simmons.
Barton Simmons. Okay. So at Barton Simmons at BudElliott3, just send those to us and we'll try to work them into the show next time. But we really appreciate all the questions you guys have been asking. I assume they're in there. I just can't see them. But I know the ratings number is going up. So we appreciate that. Our bosses see that. And we'll join you guys again soon.
See you.
Ever set foot outside of the hotel, you will be shot.
Don't miss the new Showtime limited series based on the international bestseller.
For the last 4 years, I've been a prisoner.
Why are they keeping you here?
Starring Emmy Award winner Ewan McGregor.
This is the brave new world that you dreamt of.
Be very careful. You are still a prisoner here.
Everything in this new world comes at cost.
This is still my country.
A Gentleman in Moscow, now streaming on Paramount+, only with the Paramount Plus with Showtime plan.